You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful spring day. It's been warm and sunny, but you know, it looks like it's going to get cold and rainy.
And technically it is still winter, and we have to keep saying that because, boy, people are in the mood. And as a nursery owner, I think that's absolutely wonderful, but it's a little chilly at night, and we've got a little cold weather ahead of us. We did have a week of lovely weather. It was, I think, last Sunday, we did hit 70 degrees, very close to it a couple of days there. People are definitely in the mood. A lot of shirt sleeves and shorts here in the Davis area. But you notice Lois did not start with, it's a bright sunny day in Northern California.
Is it time to plant tomatoes?
No, it is not time to plant tomatoes. You can buy tomatoes, but it is not time to plant them. And of course, we'll get into that. Temperature, first of all, well, I want to say the date. Presently, we're recording the show March 5th, 2025 for broadcast on March 6th, 2025. It's late morning as I sit here and it's 52 degrees and overcast with a chance of showers today going up to a high of only 59. So that 70 degrees a few days ago was just a memory now. Going to be going down to 40 degrees tonight. Mostly clear, but a chance of showers Thursday with a chance of showers as well, and only 55 degrees. And here we go, folks. This is the important part of the conversation. On Thursday night, it will be 38 degrees and mostly clear. Friday, 64 and sunny. Great. Friday night, 36 degrees, areas of frost. Saturday, 64 degrees and then sunny. Saturday night, clear, 39 degrees, and we have a chance of frost. I want to say that again. Friday, Saturday, and possibly Sunday, although I think Sunday night is clouds are coming back in, so the lows will only drop down to about 43 degrees. So frost. Did you hear that part? Frost as a possibility Friday night. Is it time to plant tomatoes? Of course not. With a low around 36 degrees. And I would note that 2 days ago on my farm, it was also 36 degrees. I did not see frost. It's not going to kill a tomato plant if it's 36 degrees, but it will certainly set it back if you put it.
It'll stop it in its tracks, Don.
It will indeed. It'll make several days worth of injury to the plant, not necessarily blackening the leaves or killing it. But we know that when you expose a subtropical or tropical plant to temperatures below 40, 45, 50, it causes metabolic changes and the plant slows down and indeed is stunted for, as they found in research at Cornell, several days with each exposure. So each time you do it, you're setting the plant back several days. The main thing we're looking for tomatoes is an absolute minimum night temperature of 50 degrees, nothing below that, and consistently. And with respect to peppers and eggplants, 55 to 60 degrees. So a conversation with a really nice young lady yesterday when she kind of was like, why don't you have tomatoes? They're everywhere. Yeah, you're right. They're everywhere. You go into the average hardware chain right now. One of my growers of vegetables has more than 20 varieties of tomatoes on their list right now. I could order them in for you and put them out there and have them be exposed to 36 degree temperatures. And I don't want to do that. So we have a few flats. They're in our greenhouse. And we put up a sign that says, tomatoes are in the greenhouse. Please ask for assistance. We have found this is a subtle way of saying, it's too cold to put them outside right now. Anyway, let's do this really quick review of when we plant, then we'll move on. Mid to late March, we plant beans, beets, carrots, potatoes, radishes. We don't plant tomatoes or peppers. Beans, beets, carrots, potatoes, radishes. Mid to late April, tomatoes, basil. Lots of people looking for basil. Again, not happy about low night temperatures. regular old-fashioned sweet corn. Some cucumbers can go in. Summer squash. Flowers that you can plant mid to late April. Near your vegetables are borage and sweet alyssum, and you can start planting your marigolds and your sunflowers if you wish to do that. May is when we plant peppers, eggplant, super sweet corn, melons, winter squash. Flowers at that point include cosmos, zinnias, asters, amaranth, celosia, Thai basil. I put in the flower category because that's mainly what I grow it for, but that's really when that goes in. It really needs the heat. Late May to June, watermelon, okra, and the extra hot peppers. That's your review of the sequence of planting. Some of those things, if you put them in too early, they'll be very adversely affected.
So, Don, if people couldn't write that fast when you were talking, is there a place on your business website that has this little list for people?
Yes, redwoodbarn.com. Also, it's posted on the bulletin board at our garden center and out by the vegetables, because this is the most common question we get. And by the way, why are we so insistent on this? Because I've had like old guys say, why do you do this, Don? You can just sell them tomatoes again. Because I want people to succeed at gardening. Let's put it that way. When you plant too early, it sets the plant back. If you plant tomatoes too early, they're more prone to blossom end rot. If you plant peppers too early, they never recover from it. So, you know, this sequence has just worked for me and longtime gardeners in the area. Now, interesting conversations have been, seems like the nights are warming, you know, climate change, temperatures are increasing. Are you changing your advice? I said, my advice is based on the soil temperature and the night temperatures. It's not based on the calendar. Absolutely. When I give you a calendar date, I'm saying this is the usual time we would plant. Here's another one that's an easy metric for you. 80 degrees. When it's been 80 degrees, it's probably time for you to go ahead and think about starting to plant tomatoes. And the woman who was asking why I don't have them and all this kind of thing, she goes, last year I planted in mid-March and they did fine. And I'm thinking to myself, please define fine, but that's okay. And she goes, but I just covered them up a few times. Well, yes, if you're willing to do that. I have one customer who's substantially older than me and has been gardening here his entire life, and he always plants by the middle of March. If he doesn't have them in by March 15th, he thinks he's running late. And he's been gardening here since, you know, 80 years ago, not quite 70 years ago. And he said, I said, well, what do you do if we get a cold spell? I mean, we've got frost in the horizon in our current weather forecast. Oh, I just cover them. He plants 1,000 tomato plants mid-March, and he has those little hot cap things that he puts over them, all of them. So he's covering them all to keep them warm. All right, that's fine. If you're willing to do all that stuff, absolutely. There's ways you can stretch the season. Wherever you're listening to us, there's ways you can stretch the season. Personally, I prefer to stretch the season at the other end because it's more reliable. My best harvests of tomatoes and peppers and stuff are always in September, October, and into November because we have dry, warm weather at least through the middle of October. But if you want to push it forward, and I have customers who do this, that's absolutely fine. What I don't like is garden centers and hardware stores bringing in flats and flats of summer vegetables a month and a half, 2 months early, and putting them out with no information to the customer. To me, that is not really good retailing because people are going to take them home. They're going to plant them. The plants are going to struggle. Things are going to eat them. They will turn kind of purplish. They'll get all concerned. Just wait. The soil will warm up. We live in one of the best climates in the world for growing summer vegetables. So I'll just leave it at that. And each week we'll go over the quick review of what vegetables you can plant. Okay. So KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And while you're there, look at the schedule and you'll find all kinds of great programming. And each week we like to highlight one of the other shows that's here on KDRT. Well, Eye on Sports is a talk radio show focused on local sports in the Sacramento-Davis area. And they occasionally cover national sports. The hosts, Chuck and Cody, have been involved with sporting both nationally and locally for more than 15 years. They want to share their opinions, initiate discussion to the public through conversation, occasional outside interviews. This show will not be politically driven in any way, they say. The conversation will cover results, local impact, business, and psychology of sport. Our goal is to create a lighthearted, focused conversation on everything sports related. Eye on Sports runs Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m., replays on Fridays. And for the rebroadcast time for that and all the other shows, because that does change periodically, just click on the schedule guide.
So, Don, talking about things that repeat, The Yolo County Library, it's on over on 14th Street, is got a bunch of friends. There's a whole group called the Friends of the Library. And they help when people make donations to the library and all these hundreds of books come in. If they're duplicates or they're not something that the library wants to keep and put into their collections, and this is the collections for the county, then those books are put up for sale. And every month there's a sale. This month it is March 7th through 9th, Friday from noon to 7, Saturday 10 to 5, and Sunday 10 to 3. I'll read you the things. It says featured in March. This is from their website, by the way. Better Cookbooks, a very large collection. Hmm. Books on food and agricultural production. Vintage books in German. Vogue and W, Fashion and Other magazines, and a 22-pound box of Legos.
Hey, there we go.
For best author. So the library book sale is a wonderful thing. And one of our listeners, I think his name is Andrew, isn't he? Is a very active person in this place. And he heard that Don was going to be giving away to various schools or clubs or other places that need it any old Sunset Garden books that he could come across. And he had a couple, so he gave some away. And he mentioned this to Andrew, who said, oh, we get those are things people donate to the library. Mm-hmm. So he's been bringing over, handing them to Don so that Don can give them away. So I think that's a wonderful connection.
Yeah, we were mentioning a few weeks ago the importance of having an actual valid reference resource such as the Sunset Western Garden book, which is not going to be printed again. It's never going to be, you know, there's not going to be a new edition out. But I did want to emphasize in our conversation a few weeks back that it's still an incredibly valuable resource. The encyclopedia part, sure, there's whole categories of plants that have come into the trade since the last publication that won't be in there, but it's still quite extensive. And the information in the front is the part that I think anyone new to an area or gardening with kids or you know, helping as a garden coordinator, the climate information, looking at the maps and understanding why Davis is different than Woodland and why they're different than Napa and so forth, it's still the best resource for that. Well, I now have, thanks to a listener, at least a dozen of these at my nursery. And my intent is to give them, I'm putting this out there now, to school garden coordinators, folks who are working with garden clubs, whatever it is, just so you can have your own backup reference of the Sunset Western Garden book. It may be 20 or 30 years old, but it's still a good source of information about the general aspects of gardening. And the encyclopedia portion still can be very useful. All you got to do, stop by Redwood Barn Nursery, tell us your association, which school, which group you're with, and we will probably just hand you one. This is an incredibly generous thing that they're doing at the library, and I've got this one volunteer who's helping us with this. I just feel like getting these to where they'll really make the greatest impact is something we wanted to do. So free, there's that word everybody loves, copies of old editions of the Sunset Western Garden book. I'm enjoying looking back at ones from the 1960s and 70s, which were the ones I started with way back when, and seeing how it's changed over the years. Remember when they got color photographs? Wow, that was incredible. And so, but the basic about your climate stuff, in spite of, you know, well-known changes in our climate, the basic information there is still completely valid. You look at that map and you go, oh yeah, the Delta influence, and you can figure out where the different climate zones are. If I moved to a new area and it was anywhere in the West, first thing I'd look at is the Western Garden book to figure out my climate. Then I'd go out and look at the soil, and I'd look at the trees that are doing well, and I'd be ready to jump in and completely retrain my brain about horticulture in that new region. The Sunset Western Garden book would be your starting point. So just want to put that out there, and all you got to do is stop by and mention it. Mention that you heard it. And thanks, by the way, to that listener volunteer who is helping to facilitate this. The Arboretum sale, first one coming up, is this Saturday, March 8th. If you don't have that on your schedule, first of all, that's the members appreciation sale, so you got to join. Well, you can do that. It's okay. It's easy to do that. But if you don't happen to have that on your calendar, the next one after that is Sunday, April 6th, which is for members and the public. And this is all the information about the sales, including the plant sale inventory for each sale as they come along, is at arboretum.ucdavis.edu.
Well, one of the questions that has been coming in last week, No, I can't say that because I don't know what got aired when. At some time in the past, I asked Don about my limp leaves on my abutilon, and he explained the cold reactions in some plants. Well, the question we're getting now is citrus trees. Why are the leaves yellow? And I think it's the same reason, isn't it, Don?
Yeah, it's the number one question we're getting about citrus trees right now. And this starts in December and goes basically in through March, and then the soil warms up and the problem solves itself. Why are the leaves yellow? Well, this time of year, the leaves of some varieties of citrus, not all, but many, turn yellow simply in response to cold temperatures. It's not a disease, it's not a pest, and it's not a nutrient deficiency technically. It's a nutrient issue in the plant, but it's temperature related. We had very limited cloud cover in January this year, 2025. And in fact, we had almost no rainfall in January. We had a lot of frosty mornings. It was unusually cold. And we had one very cold night at the end of January that actually did a fair bit of damage. But in general, what we saw was just cold exposure. The trees are generally not injured, and the leaves will green back up when the soil warms in March. I do like to say this is the tree kind of reminding you that it would like some fertilizer. It doesn't really need it, but if you haven't gotten 2 to 3 feet of growth on it in the last year, and it's not deep green color in the summer, then going ahead and feeding it sometime in March is a perfectly good practice. But it's not that it has a terrible deficiency. The yellowing is simply temperature related.
Well, we got another email from Tanya. Listeners might remember that she was the one who had the neighbor in the backyard. They had a fence between it, and they were trying to get hedge trees and bushes and stuff like that. So she writes, we've talked about this several times in the show. I just listened to your latest podcast, and you are both brilliant. I can absolutely water the new hedges in the neighbor's yard, and we won't even have to go under the fence. And she sent a picture. It's a brick wall is what it is, giant bricks. And one of them is turned sideways, so there's a hole through it.
There you
so
go.
She can just run the hose right through there. I'm going to set up 2 soaker hoses so that plants can be watered on both sides, that is left and right, and then have a short length of hose go through the cinder block. I will just connect my hose weekly for the first year, every 2 weeks for the second year, to deep water throughout the summer and keep these beautiful hedge plants growing. I and my neighbor are, well, this is good. And my neighbor and I, who didn't previously know each other, do now, and our families have friendly exchanges over the fence, added bonus. And I can keep my promise that he doesn't have to do anything after planting except watch them grow.
Yeah.
So no need to put this on the radio. I just feel like I've taken up so much of your time already. I did make another donation to KDRT to show my appreciation.
Well, thank you.
Thank
we love
you
that.
Both again so much. I can't wait for these little hedges to grow up so we can enjoy them.
So this is interesting because I once got in the middle of a dispute between neighbors where a hedge was being planted, and the neighbors got into a big fight about it. It was, you know, I was standing there where one woman was saying to the other, "This is a spite hedge. You're just doing this because you don't like us." And it turned into this horrible conflict. It shouldn't be that way. We should plan our yards together to the extent that's possible. I got in the middle of another one where a tree had been planted that was going to shade solar panels. And the question came to me, can they prune it? And I looked at it and looked at the species and said, yes, it could be pruned, but let's, you know, talk about this, not turn it into some sort of fight or lawsuit. Your yards are together. Your yards are shared in so many ways. The wildlife that goes between them, the way a branch will hang over laden with peaches or oranges or something. You know, if we can cooperate, it just makes such a huge difference. And this is going to be a pleasurable thing for both sides of the fence rather than a source of conflict. So I think this is wonderful the way this has turned out. Also, the weight of my heart is chocolate, coffee, and flattery. So you just did all.
Okay. So next question. This is from Annie in San Rafael. My first question is that there seems to be something eating the bark. I added flaming hot chili oil to my bird seed to discourage squirrels.
I wanted to know your take on that. I don't think they taste hot pepper, right? Did it work?
Why would you put hot chili oil on your bird seed? I mean,
she said,
it can't be good for the birds, can it?
I don't think it matters.
I understand that the squirrels wouldn't like it. I mean, they're mammals and they'd spit it out.
I don't think the birds would care, but I was curious if you had any opinion about that. Does it,
I would have to go and look that up. I okay. just generally don't add anything to seeds.
Maybe it works.
Except seeds.
Our first question back to the listener is, are the birds showing any objection to the pepper oil?
I will look this up, and I will tell you next week what I have found out, whether hot chili oil is good for birds or not.
Okay, but more to the point, anyway, with respect to the bark, there is a product called hot pepper wax, which you can buy at hardware stores and some nurseries sell it. It's basically cayenne pepper powder or something in a wax solution. So you can spray it onto things and it sticks because the wax then dries and holds it on there. And although it was originally introduced as an insecticide many years ago, 20, 30 years ago, immediately people thought, maybe this will work as an animal repellent. And it does seem to work in that regard. Looking at the picture of the bark, I couldn't tell for sure whether that was torn off by a squirrel or tree rat, but it's the fairly characteristic damage we get from those animals, where they just start removing the bark and they go down through the bark, through the cambium, and can do a lot of damage. We always get this question here in the valley in late summer, when like a whole branch of a citrus tree will die. And people come in, they think it's a disease. And I said, no, get in there, look closely. You'll see the injury from the animal. In that instance, spraying it with some sort of hot pepper, some formulation you've come up with might actually work as a repellent, hard to say, but you can actually buy one that is already there. It's called red hot pepper wax. And you could just go ahead and spray with that and give it a try. If it's an ongoing problem, I end up recommending just get some barrier, just wrapping that part of the trunk if they're coming back to it with some sort of fine poultry wire, or more to the point, do a little pruning to open things up so they don't feel safe hiding in there and chewing on the bark, or some combination of those activities.
Okay, next question. Changing the subject, our neighbor's pine tree has exploding pine cones that annually litter my yard. See photos. I was wondering how they affect my plants. Will they compost? Doesn't seem like they do so over the winter. If they do compost, what nutrients would they provide? Despite my wishes to murder the tree, I believe I will just have to live with it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you'll have to live with it.
If it's not your tree, yes, although this could be a conversation with a neighbor. Pine cones take a very, very, very long time to break down. They're basically wood or bark-like, and they do actually, as I recall, contain the substance, the suberin, which is water repellent. So getting them to break down just inert, just the whole pine cone itself could take decades, could take 10, 15 years or more. But if you ran it through a chipper, if you're already running stuff through a chipper and happen to throw the pine cones in while you're doing that, that would help to break them down. They're not harmful in any way. They're also not all that beneficial because of how long it takes them to break down. Any kind of organic material does contain a little bit of nitrogen, some phosphorus, some potassium. So they do function with plant, they do provide plant nutrients as they break down. But basically, they're just sort of a thing that's there, not giving you a whole lot of benefit, but not doing any harm either. Common question we get about things off of pines or redwoods is, don't they make the soil more acidic? Yes, over millennia, but not over decades or generations. They take a very, 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 very long time to cause any change in soil pH, if they ever do. So that wouldn't be a factor. They're just a thing that's there, and they don't give you any particular advantage, nor do they do any harm.
Okay. And these are pine cones. I mean, couldn't you just rake them up?
Sure. Yeah. Or, cover
remove
them,
with, throw cover them back with, over the
cover
fence.
Them with suet and hang them on the bird feeder, right?
No, not this kind of pine cone. It's all moldy and cruddy. And
it's that one's been breaking down for a while. But yes, I would just.
Well, it's got stuff growing on it.
I mean, the only issue I have is they're flammable. So, and they're kind of fun to burn.
Oh,
yeah.
That'd be stinky, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would smell like, and they pop when you burn them.
This question involves a soil product, Miracle-Gro Organic Choice Potting Soil with Compost, which she bought from Costco. Last year, I put it on top of my raised beds, and I didn't think about it when my zucchini, eggplant, and a couple of tomatoes failed. This winter, I had a huge crop of various mushrooms pop up in my soil. My 75-year-old husband picked up a bunch of the bags of the same product last week and decided that maybe I should just order the rest of them for delivery online. When I went to their website, I saw that it was rated 1 star instead of 5, And that there are hundreds of product reviews from people who had the same problems that I had last year. Oh dear. I can't ask my husband to return these bags unless it's absolutely necessary. Should I turn over the soil to incorporate this stuff from last year? Should I remove the couple of inches of topsoil? And what do I do with the 8 bags of new stuff? I imagine I can hire a strong young man to return that if it's what you recommend.
Miracle-Gro suffers from a public reputation problem, and people love to give bad reviews to all of their products. And so when I look at something online, I see many, 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 many poor reviews. Part of it is that Scott's Miracle-Gro company, there's just a whole lot of people that don't like them. So that may be what you're dealing with. But this is a generalization. The cheaper the potting soil or planting mix that you buy, the poorer quality it will be, and the more likely it is to just be predominantly compost or something that isn't really officially compost, more like shavings and some sort of byproduct of agriculture. I would not incorporate those. I certainly wouldn't use them as potting soil. Putting it on the surface shouldn't be a problem. It shouldn't have. I would be more curious about why or how your vegetables failed in that area last year. But the huge crop of various mushrooms popping up in the soil suggests to me that there's a lot of uncomposted organic material in that bag of soil that then broke down, because mushrooms are a sign that things are breaking down, and could well have tied up nitrogen and made the plants fail to thrive for that reason. So I'm not a fan of buying the cheapest bagged product. I'd rather have you pay twice as much and buy half as many bags, because you'll get better results. I will tell you that what makes bagged goods expensive is when the manufacturer adds organic fertilizers like bat guano or seabird guano or crab meal or things like that, which will give you significant benefit, but significantly increase the cost of the bagged product. There is no standardization in our industry about these bagged products. The fact that they're calling that potting soil is very unfortunate, because if you use that in a container and plant it into it, the plant would almost certainly show some yellowing and fail to grow, because you wouldn't have enough nitrogen, because it would still be breaking down. It wouldn't be available to the plant. If you've done this and it's already in there in the container or in a raised bed, just go ahead and get something like fish emulsion or your favorite soluble fertilizer and start feeding the plants early on in their growth cycle until you get good deep green color and you're getting the growth that is appropriate. Be cautious with some summer vegetables like tomatoes not to overfeed them, because too much nitrogen on a tomato plant, it'll just grow like crazy and you won't get very good yield. But if they're not growing at all, and you know it wasn't because you planted too early, if they're not growing at all, it could be that there was nitrogen tied up because the product just wasn't good quality. I don't want to dump on a well-known brand, but this is something we run into, is that sometimes the stuff wasn't fully composted. There's a certain degree of temperature that it's supposed to come to be called compost. It's a regulated term in the state of California. Other states, perhaps not. No, I wouldn't necessarily rake it all off of there, or I certainly would not incorporate it. It should be okay just as a surface mulch, but you may have to augment the nitrogen. You'll almost certainly have to augment the nitrogen for the young plants as they're getting established. That's probably what I would do with it. And perhaps use it more around where your flowers are, things like that. Again, when you're buying these products, read the label. Not the product name, that's not really relevant necessarily. Something called planting mix, potting soil, it could be almost anything. Flip it over and read the back and look what's in it. And they list them in the order of magnitude, that is to say largest amount first and so forth. Look for what kind of fertilizer is in there. And if there's no organic fertilizer in there, then you're basically just buying a bag of almost composted compost. That's okay, but you're going to have to bump up the nitrogen usage, and you're going to have to provide that separately. And the simplest one, fish emulsion or something like it in a watering can, water the plants every couple of weeks with a solution of that following the label directions. Look for good color, look for good growth when we get into warmer weather. You've probably solved the problem that was created.
So it sounds like this is a seasonal situation, a seasonal bed. And when you're going to plant your next season's plants, you're going to have to scrape the mulch away in order to get down to the dirt anyway.
Or incorporate it. And that's the question that's being asked.
No. You just said don't incorporate
right.
it.
Right. So don't. That. Yes, correct.
I
yes.
don't. So I'm going to plant a zucchini, an eggplant, a tomato, whatever I'm going to plant. So I've got the plant. I'm going to scrape the top off till I get to the actual soil. I'm going to dig a hole and plant my plant. Right. Now, at that point, would this be one of those unusual situations where putting a little sure starter or something in there would be good, because then you'd be fertilizing the plant as you planted it?
Yeah, you can put any kind of fertilizer that is appropriate to your vegetables in the hole. You mix it in. I've done that for years. I've only stopped doing that because I'm taking all my little tomato plants when they come home, and I'm collecting my tomatoes and peppers. I know I've already set up the table for it. I already have the pots there. I already have the bag of soil. As they come home, before I do anything else, they go from the 4-inch pot into a gallon can in my enriched potting soil, the high quality stuff that costs 5 times as much as what they're buying at Costco. And I use that and I grow the plant into that. And since I know there's a gallon can's worth of enriched potting soil that's very high quality there, I just plant with that and the plant has all the fertilizer that it needs. But you haven't necessarily done that. So yes, a little bit of Sure Start is one brand, or you know, one name, product name, tomato, vegetable, food. Those are all fine. Yeah, they have more phosphorus than I prefer, but there's no getting away from that. If you happen to have a higher nitrogen product, just use it carefully and just mix it down there. Or if you didn't do that, side dress with it, which means on the soil, not on the mulch on top, but on the soil around the plant. Or, as I say, mix it up. This is one of the reasons I come back to things like fish emulsion. You mix it up in a watering can, you know it'll get to the root zone because you're watering enough to get it down to the root zone. So yeah, some source of nitrogen at planting, shortly after planting, a month later when you realize it's not doing well. It doesn't matter exactly when you do it, but you will need some source of nitrogen in there.
And Annie closes her email with, "I have learned so much from your intelligent, educated, and thoughtful advice every week. Thank you."
Yes, thank you very much. And
Don just got his chocolate for the day.
Yes, you do get what you pay for with bagged products. And there's no, again, it's frustrating to me, but there's no standardization. There are rules about calling something compost. One of the reasons you aren't finding bags of compost at garden centers is that a few years ago, the state of California made compost a regulated term. For us to sell it to you as compost, or for the city of Davis to tell you what they're giving you is compost, it has to be brought to a particular internal temperature that is documented. In the case of the manufacturers that I buy from, they would have to submit that documentation for every batch to the state of California. So most of them thought, this isn't that important to most people. So they stopped calling their products compost. It doesn't there's only one bag of anything in my nursery that says compost on it. It actually says organic compost. And those are two regulated terms right there. So they have to go to a lot of extra effort to have it say that on the bag. They're putting the same stuff in the bags they were before, but they don't feel like documenting the fact that it got up to 139 degrees internal temperature for a 72-hour period over the following blah, blah, blah. They ain't going to do that. They're just telling me, yeah, that's what we do. Trust us. And you know what? Because of the company I work with, I do.
Okay. So our next question comes from Andrew here in Davis. Hi, Don and Lois. My wife and I are thinking we would like to create one or more raised berms in our yard, and for both graphic relief in an otherwise flat as a board yard, and to create an area to plant and display our collection of cactuses and other succulents. He actually says cacti. But you know, I translate that to cactuses.
We have room
for one of the berms to be approximately 15 feet long by 5 feet wide at the base and be curved at one end. We want the top to be at least 15 inches or so wide, but we have questions, and very likely you will have important considerations concerning matters of which we haven't even thought. Our question so far is the following. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll just give you the six topics.
Yeah.
Ratio of height to width, berm soil, berm compaction, berm foundation, plantings, that is plantings on the side as well as the top, and irrigation. So let's start with the first one, ratio of height to width.
Well, a very important point is our collection of cacti and other succulents, which need, it's very important that the water drain away from them during the winter time. I'm glad that he distinguished between them, because cacti are generally cold hardy. You don't usually have to worry about their exposure to winter cold. There are cactus that grow in Wyoming. I mean, there are tropical cactus, but for the most part, true cactus, members of Cactaceae and the ones you're thinking of, can take cold temperatures quite well. What they can't take is cold temperatures followed by wet weather. And that's the biggest loss of cactus and succulents that we encounter here is when we have them out in the open, they get rained on right after a freezing event. So if the freeze caused some injury to the plant, rain immediately sets in with bacterial soft rot and the plant just collapses and that's that. But if water drains through, you don't generally have that problem. The cold itself is not an issue. So when you're planting cactus right out in the open, you just want water to always percolate away from the crown of the plant. And that goes for succulents as well, but they're more variable with respect to cold hardiness. So cactus, I'm not as concerned about. Succulents, we'd need to see the whole list and discuss whether, you know, this aloe is hardy and so on. I'm not going to get into that. But that's
Andrew, being a collector, is well aware of that variability, and he probably knows which one will go outside and which one will stay indoors.
Yeah, and we often find out the hard way. You know, one night in the mid-20s that we had in late January did some injury to some, and you get used to that. But the key is if they get cold injury, put them where they're dry, and you can usually save the plant. One of the reasons that you will often add things to a berm for better percolation is if you're growing plants where you're very concerned about drainage and you don't want them to rot. So I don't usually recommend adding weird rock materials to berms or raised planters because it drains out too fast. But cactus and succulents, too fast isn't a problem. So if this was a berm for flowers and shrubs and things, we'd be having a slightly different conversation.
So you're talking about question two is the berm soil, what it's made out of. But let's get back to the ratio of the height to the width, because if it's 5 feet across at the base, what angle can you do? Can you do a 45 degree angle? I'm sure you can't do anything more than 45.
It depends on what you are making it from. So geologists know about the angle of repose, which is the particular slope at which rock things will start falling down and eroding away. But soil is different than that. Soil is interlocking rocks with stuff in there. Many people who think from a geologic standpoint are just thinking like a pile of sand. Yeah, that'll erode. It won't stay put. When I moved here to Northern California, I came from a place where I was gardening on 1 foot of sandy topsoil on top of sandstone. It was the mildest climate in the world, coastal San Diego, but I had to water a lot because water would run through that sand. And if I tried to mound it up in any way, my dad had just bought in whatever topsoil he could get. And, you know, there's no soil in coastal San Diego. You don't really have anything to work with. I was basically piling up sand and it would just slump right back down. It would erode right away. And I move here where we have loam soils, and I'll define that in a moment. And I found, wow, the soil particles, I'm learning in my early courses in horticulture and soil science, interlock and actually hold the position you put them in. I found that I could sculpt soil. My first vegetable garden, their drip systems weren't common back then. This was, you know, before the Civil War. Drip systems didn't exist. You couldn't even buy them. So I found that I could dig a trench and take the soil from the trench and pile it up and pile it from the other side. So now my garden furrow is, you know, 12 to 18 inches high. And it would hold that position. I couldn't believe it. This was like a revelation to me. I could rake it and it would keep that position. And I quickly started making garden beds that were 12 to 18 inches high, 2 to 3 feet across, and they would hold that position because loam soils are made up of clay, silt, and sand in varying proportions. And a true loam is an even mix of those things. That means you have little tiny particles, clay, intermediate particles, silt, and large chunky particles, sand, it's large by soil science standards, interlocking and forming ionic attraction between the particles. And then the roots of the plants grow, and we now know mycorrhiza fill in between them. And the soil, the term I use, the soil knits. It begins to hold the position. It didn't do that in my soil in coastal San Diego. There wasn't enough nutrient base. There wasn't enough organic material for the beds to hold their own position. But here, anywhere you're listening, Davis, Dixon, Woodland, Vacaville, this general valley area, we have these loamy soils. People often think loam means fertile with a lot of organic material. No, it actually refers to this mix of mineral particles, but a reasonably evenly distributed mix of the different sizes. So they interlock, they form a reasonable surface, and they hold together. And as time goes by, you grow things on there, and there's roots, and you've got mycorrhiza forming connections and vastly increasing the root zone of the plants. that holds it together even better. So when we're talking about problems you've had with raised beds, one of the first things we say is just start building that soil. I know you bought in the fancy stuff and drains too fast. All right, grow a cover crop and then cut it down. Don't pull it. Let the roots disintegrate. Mulch heavily. Add arborist wood chips. We know as soon as you do that, or fungus and bacteria move right up into them and back down. And they're helping to pull that all together. So your soil does hold itself. Erosion is not the concern you think it's going to be up to a point. You go with a 4 or 5 foot berm, yeah, you're going to start to have some problems. But 18 to 24 inches, no problem at all. Even up to 36 inches. Obviously, if you pile it up, it's going to slump back down. But you will find pretty quickly that that berm will hold its shape. And then the question he does ask, would it work to create a shallow depression running most of the length of the top as a type of catch basin? Each new plant will need its own little catch basin at first, yes. Just because you'll find that the water won't stay where it needs to. But that does depend on how you're watering and what the infiltration rate is of the soil that you chose to fill it with.
So I'm getting back to the angle, 45 degrees?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's so probably a little steep, but it'll probably.
A little steep, it should be 30?
I would try 45, and you know, it depends on what he's after, but my guess is they don't need that much of a slope.
Yeah. Now, when you're constructing this thing, a berm is just soil that's been mounded up. I understand that.
Yep.
What if I were to build an open-bottomed, open-topped, well, obviously open-topped, like a raised planter, and then cover the whole thing in soil?
Same thing.
Soil inside, soil outside. It would keep the structure better, wouldn't it?
Sure. There's a bunch of ways to do this. Retaining walls, buying those interlocking pavers. You can buy a Basalite is a brand that makes them. Those are very handy, by the way. I've often talked people into this where they want to make a berm and they don't have enough room, but they want it pretty high. All right, you go get those things. You just stack them. Basically, they're concrete, but they interlock, and that can get you up 12 to 18 inches just that way. And then you have more flexibility. You can go even higher if you have some reason to want to do that. So there's ways to hold it back. It's not necessary. A pile of dirt will hold the shape once the soil particles begin to interlock. The ionic attraction and the action of the soil organisms in there will knit it all together.
Okay. And then so you talked about berm soil, what to put in there. And he says, it's been recommended we include lava rock to improve internal drainage, given the low water plants that will live there. Is this a beneficial material to incorporate, and what percentage, et cetera, et cetera? It's also been suggested that we incorporate urbanite, broken up chunks of concrete into the berm. What say ye? Okay. Beyond any inclusions, the berm will comprise only the native clay loam soil from other areas of our yard.
In general, you want to start with your native soil. Putting a new fancy soil on top of native soil always leads to a problem right at the interface between the two soil types, and roots have difficulty penetrating. So the fact that he's using native soil from other parts of the yard is really great. Those of you listening who can't do that, it does create issues when you fill, you know, let's say you put a sandy loam on top of a clay loam soil, water runs through the sandy loam, hits the other layer, spreads out laterally at that point, makes a saturated zone. Roots typically have difficulty penetrating that. So if you can use native soil, great. Chunks of concrete would be a great way to get rid of chunks of concrete, but that's the only benefit of it. I can't see why anyone would particularly want to do that. However, I do know people who install low water landscapes and cactus gardens and succulent gardens, and they very commonly add lava rock or pumice or something like that. They typically incorporate it into the top few inches so that you get that really important air exchange around the crown and the roots of these little more sensitive plants like cactus and succulents. And if you're growing plants from Australia or South Africa, some of them are fussy in that regard as well. There's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't provide nutrients, and it does create a little more air exchange right around the crown of the plant. Typically, you only incorporate those 3 to 6 inches. If someone out there does this professionally, send me a note, davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I'd be curious what you do. I've read on forums in the UK that they use cat litter or whatever. I mean, it really doesn't matter that much what it is. The idea is to enhance the likelihood that water will flow away from the crown of the plant and not lead to crown rot. So that's the purpose of the lava rock or pumice or any of those types of materials.
Is it true that cactus and succulents have shallow roots or do they have deep roots?
We presume, obviously, we're guessing in many cases, but generally speaking, they go out and out and out and out. I remember a fascinating root excavation study of an ocotillo that was 6 inches tall that had roots going more than 18 feet
Wow.
in each direction. It was not in, but it was near a wash, which is, if you're in the desert, you know that water flows in very predictable areas. You can see where it flows very rapidly in those areas. And they excavated it. These roots went way past what you would ever imagine a little tiny 6-inch ocotillo might have. And they went almost entirely very shallow. They tend to be well protected. They often have a woody covering or an epidermis on the root that enables it to go dry and just sort of hunker down and wait months if it has to between waterings. The other thing they found, as soon as irrigation, rainfall occurred, root hairs formed within 24 hours. The plant would absorb a massive amount of water, which it stored in specialized cells, and then could, the rain stopped, it dries out, all those root hairs die, the root goes back to its woody component, and it can live for weeks, months, even years in some cases on the water that it has stored in these specialized water holding cells. But the key th thing to know about those is they're vulnerable to infection. They're vulnerable to rapid movement in the plant of a bacterial infection. So bacterial soft rot is one of the worst things that can happen on cactus. So because of their adaptation to long intervals between irrigation, ability to take it up rapidly, they're also vulnerable to staying too wet around the crown. Bear in mind, though, a lot of these are plants that come from places where it does rain in the summer. Not much, but it rains all at once in the summer. Tucson, Arizona got 6 inches of rain in July a couple of years ago. And that's not uncommon. That's their wettest month, actually. So these are plants that adapt to rapid uptake and then stopping uptake, but the roots go out quite a ways. You'd be surprised how far cactus roots can go.
So the next two questions he had about are berm compaction and berm foundation. I think you spoke a little bit to it, but on the berm foundation, are there any special materials that would be placed around the base circumference of the berm, such as we described? I've seen rocks and edging placed around a berm circumference, seemingly to hold things in place. It doesn't sound like, Don, it sounds like you said they aren't
No,
necessary.
they're not necessary. They can be handy ways to plant. So, for example, planting on the slope part of the berm can be challenging unless you figured out some way to hold the water back around the plant when you irrigate. So, let's say you want to plant a trailing succulent in there and you want to water it until it's established. Well, if it's on a 30-degree slope, the water's just going to run off, even if you put it on fairly slowly. So, putting in something that makes just a little level area right around the individual plant or a little group of plants can mean the water will flow down, stop there, soak in rather than simply flowing over. So they do have advantages in terms of managing the early irrigation. They're mostly done just for the look. What a lot of people are doing with berms is creating sort of a backyard natural drainage look. They're trying to get some height. They want some curves and all that kind of thing. These can be ways to get plants on the corners and edges and slopes and have them established better. That's really the only purpose of those is either aesthetics or to help with that irrigation issue. You don't need to compact the soil. It'll compact itself. You can do, well, let's put it this way. You can do that by watering. You can put the soil down, you can rake it out, you can water, put on a half inch of water, let it settle, smooth it out, do that again. You don't need to take anything and pack it down if that's what you're thinking of. That's sometimes done for other reasons, but there's no particular need for it here.
Okay, and so he's talking about planting on the top with the cacti and succulents, and then down the side, he was thinking maybe that the plants on the side might help stabilize things, but it sounds like it isn't necessary. When you planted on the side, would you also want to incorporate in that top 2 inches or so the same lava rock type stuff that you're putting on the top to keep it from having water standing by the
It's
crowns?
very, very unlikely that you would have water standing or collecting around a plant that's on the slope. It's better. He actually asked an interesting question. Would we carve appropriately sized horizontal shelves into the berm side where we desire a particular plant? Yes, that may be the only way to get them watered and rooted in. I helped friends in Lafayette years ago who were trying to plant a slope that was about 50 degrees or more. And so we ran a drip line above the plants on that slope. And then each plant had its own little basin So that when it came down from the dripper, it would collect at least briefly around the plant we had just put in, and a fair bit of it would soak in there. And that worked, because when we first tried to plant and they ran the drip line, you could see it, little rivulets of erosion going down the slope, and nothing was getting where it needed to. So we quickly realized we did have to plan, at least for the first year or two of the plant's growth, for water to collect briefly, not too long, but briefly, long enough to soak in so the plant got the watering that it needed. So yes, the appropriately sized horizontal shelves, I even in this particular case, because it was such a steep slope, I made a slight little depression on the downhill side of the plant. So water would come flowing down, bubble up and gather a little bit of the base of the plant, soak in, and then run off. That reduced the erosion and the plants established well. And within a season, you typically know the roots will get out there, and many, many plants can take to that kind of slope. There's many plants that live preferentially, including some of our natives, and some succulents would be fine on those kind of slopes. Would it weaken or strengthen the berm side? I don't think
that depends on how long the plant lives.
Yeah. And the roots will help to stabilize it. And in a case like this, yes, the roots will help to stabilize it in the long run, depending, of course, on what it is.
And the sixth point is irrigation. We will be using Netafim type drip lines, which are output a 0.6 GPH every 12 inches. These lines would, of course, go on the top of the berm, but would they also go into the side of the berm above and adjacent to the berm side plants? Again, would this weaken or strengthen the berm sides? And you were talking about having a drip system. So maybe it just means that you should plant your plants 12 inches apart.
Well, that's one option, yeah.
Now, well, I mean, to match the drip lines that you're putting in.
And the thing to know about the Netafim product is that this 0.6 gallon per hour, they have one that's even lower output, you have to run them a long time to get a good deep soaking. They're great for ground covers, where you only need to water 6 to 12 inches deep, because if you run it for 30 to 60 minutes, that's the only depth you're going to get. To water a woody plant or something that's a bigger plant, they really need to run for at least a couple hours. And this is always our issue with these emitterized tubing products, Netafim being the best known brand. When I say emitterized tubing, this is where the tubing has the emitters incorporated into it. You have different outputs, different spacing. He's got one that's very popular with landscapers, 0.6 gallons an hour is what GPH stands for, every 12 inches. To get a foot depth of watering, that would need to run probably for a full hour. With a slope, with a soil like you're bringing in, you may not be able to do that all at once. You may find that after 30 minutes, it's beginning to run off and beginning to at least erode a little bit initially. In the long run, that shouldn't be a problem. So to get the depth of watering, this is true whenever you use Netafim, it's very likely you'll have to do multiple start times for shorter intervals, let's say 20 minutes, and then an hour later, 20 minutes, and an hour later, 20 minutes, so that you're working with the infiltration rate of your soil and getting it into the soil, not running off the soil. But that's a management thing after it's installed. They'll go on the top of the berm, they go on the sides of the berm above the plants that are on the side. And I don't think, depending on how quickly the plants establish, that would either weaken or strengthen the berm size. I'm not concerned about that, as long as your flow isn't high enough to literally be, you know, running off when you irrigate it. You'll have to adjust. You'll have to test and try and see how long you can run it before you get water flowing off. And it may be only 20 minutes, and I'm telling you it needs to run for an hour. Well, you know how that works. 20 minutes, then an hour later, 20 minutes, then an hour later, 20 minutes. Just make sure you run it long enough, ultimately.
So you're saying 20 minutes an hour three times. Is that every day?
No, shouldn't need to be more than once a week or even less for these very low water plants. But in your vegetable garden, which is a very similar situation, what he's asking here is the same kind of issues people are dealing with when they make a raised vegetable planter and fill it with soil. Or they have a very, very large tub that may be hopefully connected through the soil below. You will have to adjust your irrigation to your soil infiltration rate and its soil and the water retention capacity of that soil. And many people with raised beds who have filled them with the fanciest topsoil they can buy locally find they have to water daily the first year, second year. And as time goes by, they don't have to do it as often because the roots have gotten in there and created something that's really more of a soil. Most people who I know who have raised vegetable gardens run their drip systems for about 20 to 30 minutes a day, every day in our summer here. It's not that much more water than what I'm applying. They just can't do it all at once like I can. You know, I've got garden soil, so I can do that a week's worth of water all at once if I happen to want to do that. You got a raised planter with vegetables, you can't do that. Gravity is a problem. The water drains out, so you have to keep applying water typically daily or every other day. Most of our conversations with the people, July to August, the problems they're having in their vegetable gardens, which are very similar to Andrew's berm here, the water drains out past out of the root zone. So they have to keep applying it. So in that case, yes, you may be doing it daily. And you just have to figure out how long you have to run it to get the depth of irrigation that you're after.
Okay. And Andrew ends his question with a few things. I'm going to read a couple lines. Looking back over this email, I realize I'm asking a lot for you to digest, contemplate, and opine upon. I didn't mean to do that. So please just do what you think is reasonable on this topic. You are our horticultural heroes and do a great job of covering all of your presented weekly issues. Boy. Three cheers for the Davis Garden Show. Thank you, Andrew. And thank you to all those listeners out there who are cheering along with him. And you can write and tell us. We like that.
The elevation is an interesting issue because people, they get frustrated. They spend a lot of money building a big planter box or making a berm or something like this, and then they have water management issues. And as long as you realize that you've essentially created almost a container soil on top of your native soil, in almost every situation, you're bringing in something that isn't native to your garden, there's going to be management issues. But the good news is, over time, you can create good soil out of almost anything. And you can do that by making use of cover crops, by top mulching, with, you know, mulching on top with good quality compost materials. And in some cases with things like arborist wood chips, which will help to retain moisture and will gradually break down. So I'm always frustrated when people have gone to a lot of expense to build raised planters, plant everything. We get to our first hot spell, they're really struggling and they give up. No, you generally just need to water more. And also you'll almost certainly need to provide more nutrients for vegetables, flowers, things like that. Cactus and succulents, that's not typically an issue. But for gardening in raised planters or on berms, you will need to adapt for the first couple of years. You'll have to water more frequently than you think, probably, depending on what the plants are. And you'll probably need to apply nutrients one way or another. There's three basic ways water gets into your soil. Pressure. That is to say the hose or the sprinkler or the rainfall, throwing it onto the soil and pushing it into the soil. Our old friend capillary action, which is molecule to molecule movement of water laterally down and up. Water moves in all directions by capillary action. And third, gravity. Gravity can be your friend, but in this instance, gravity is part of your challenge because gravity, water drains out of something that's been elevated. And so you may have great soil, but if the whole zone has no available water, plants aren't going to grow in it. And so you have to adjust for that. And gravity is your problem with berms and with raised planters.
So we usually end with a garden quote. And I've been collecting some of these and people have been sending them in, which I really appreciate. So this one is a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson. What is a weed? A weed is a plant whose virtues have not been discovered.
Correct. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.